At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, and hour three upon us. Actually, 10 minutes in already. I said this was going to be a fast moving morning, and that has been the case. Casey calling Tim Layden back after a kind of a spotty signal, and we'll look forward to Tim joining us, hopefully with a clear as a bell reception. Tim, good morning.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Excellent. And, you know, it's a good thing you put up that logo, you know, the picture on your Twitter bio with the mask. Otherwise, I wouldn't have recognized you Saturday at Travers.
We're all getting to recognize each other better from the nose up, you know?
It's a funny scenario, and certainly you've been kind of covering the sports scene in your role for NBC with a real pandemic umbrella. And before we talk about racing, your overall thoughts about how these last 5 months have evolved, and where we're heading, and then we can weave in the racing portion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not just I don't see any way to write about any part of life in America right now without addressing that pandemic umbrella you just referred to, Steve. I mean, that sort of is the shadow that's over everyday life, and that includes sports. And I think it's been important to try and write about how sports are trying to function, but also to question sort of at every turn, how important is it and how should we be interacting with all of it? And I think all of that isn't so much that I'm trying to be anybody's conscience or big brother here. I'm just reflecting the way my own conscience is responding to all of it. And as I've written about sports in the last 5 months, and as I've attended sporting events and done work in the field, I've been very conscious of the times we live in, and I find it hard to believe that anybody wouldn't be. It's great that we have some sports to watch, but at the same time, it's not normal, and trying to squeeze it into some normal box just doesn't work for me. So that's what I've tried to reflect.
From a successful execution standpoint, tis the law, may end up being a monolith of sorts, because your story kind of began with his Belmont success, which was really in the shadow of the worst, at least at that time, the worst outbreak scenario, which was in the New York metropolitan area. And racing has been resolute and has really been successful in getting first back up and running. Plus, there were the seven ovals, two quarter horse, five thoroughbred that managed to keep operating through the worst of things in March and April. But it really feels like racing is distinguishing itself. I've been saying this for months in light of everything going on around it.
I think so. I mean, obviously racing has had issues. They have had cases. They have had deaths. But they haven't had an overwhelming outbreak. Obviously, Del Mar had to close for a few days because of the jockey situation. And I think the lesson learned from that is the same lesson that all of sports has learned, which is that this stuff works better the more you make it a bubble, and it works worse the more you try to make it normal. And I think racing has done a good job of staying on the correct side of that line with a few hiccups, and I just think that that's almost impossible to avoid. And I think racing has tried to learn its lesson from that. I will say that being at Saratoga on Saturday for the Travers, there were more people there as spectators than I expected to see. And, you know, again, I'm on the conservative side of virus behavior, so I was a little tiny red flag that my brain was waving for me at the number of people near the finish line on Saturday. But at the same time, you know, that's what everybody's doing every day, is trying to figure out to what extent we can kind of take back a little pieces of our life. And I just saw that happening in real time on Saturday. But to your initial point, I do think racing has stayed on the right side of trouble throughout this, and I think racing was well positioned to do that because of the nature of the financial structure of the sport. You can bet on racing without being at the racetrack. You can bet on basketball without being at a basketball arena, but basketball isn't as dependent upon that revenue as racing is. So there are differences.
One part of the way this story seems to be headed when it comes to the oddball Triple Crown and more is the presence of, you know, a throwback of you know, 16 years when it comes to Funnyside, Sacatoga, Barkley Tag, Robin Smulin. The only thing we're missing is Jose Santos and the Funnyside story. And obviously there's chapters to write, Tim. The part of this to me that is really engaging is we have the now unflappable Barkley Tag, who was flappable during the Funnyside campaign, and his success, his ongoing success, his career, and what he and partner Robin Smulin have authored here is really fairly remarkable, and it parallels the Funnyside success. It's impossible not to make the, you know, the comparisons and the parallels.
Sure, and I think that's, you know, I did a piece for NBC before the Belmont on Jack Knowlton and his family struggles and the way that he's worked through all that, and also the incredible unlikelihood of a relatively small stable that doesn't have huge financial support and doesn't play this game in volume at the highest level, getting two horses. Sizzalaw hasn't won the Kentucky Derby yet, but he's won a Belmont, a Travers, and a Florida Derby 17 years after Funnyside. It's not, as you all know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the regular guy on the street gets a great racehorse. But that regular guy in the street doesn't get a great racehorse twice. And that really is the remarkable thing about Sacatoga and Tis the Law, who we don't really know yet, but boy, he looks like the real thing, and, you know, possibly a quantum leap better than Funnyside, who was a Kentucky Derby and Preakness and Jockey Club Gold Cup winner. And Barkley, you know, Barkley Tag is a character, and I think during Funnyside's run 17 years ago, when Barkley was a young lad of only 65, I think he did get annoyed with all the attention that comes with suddenly being the Derby-winning trainer. This time around, he has said some funny things. You know, at the Belmont, he said he kind of liked all the quiet with no spectators there, and nobody else processed it that way that I know of. And the other thing, obviously, on Saturday, he was asked that same thing. Would you rather have won with a full grandstand here? And he said, the purse is the same. I think we are into that stage now where Barkley is playing the role of Barkley Tag curmudgeon. I think he knows what he's doing. I think he's enjoying this. And I think his curmudgeonly and taciturn asides are now part of this game that Barkley Tag is playing with all of us, and I think he's enjoying it.
There's a part of this when it came to the team winning a Belmont and a Travers that it is a, to some degree, and now with the Derby and the Preakness lying ahead, and then further down the road, the Breeders' Cup, there's an epilogue in my mind, Tim, and I don't know how many references there's been to the incident post-Derby with Funnyside, the Miami Herald, I mean, the completely insane idea that Jose Santos was using a buzzer. I mean, it was a bizarre situation that then contributed to Santos riding aggressively to the romping win in the Preakness. And, the pressures at that time, fold in Bobby Frankel, who absolutely was playing a villain during particularly the 3 week lead up and was doing everything he could to kind of throw off Barkley and company. I mean, there were a lot of things that went on that I think people have completely forgotten about when it came to Funnyside, and winning a Belmont and a Travers kind of puts, I think, some of that unpleasantry to bed.
Sure, some of it. Everything is so different this year, and you're right about the intensity of that situation back in 2003. There is an intensity all to its own that comes to the Derby winner in any year. And Sakatoga and Barkley and Jose was the most prepared to deal with all that, but Jose was a sensitive guy, and he was very hurt by that. And you're right, he got into Funnyside with a big lead in the Preakness, and who knows what kind of effect that had on the Belmont performance, or that, I can't remember whether it was a half mile or five furlong workout Belmont week, which was way too fast.
Yeah.
Funnyside basically ran off on Robin that morning, and it was just too much. But in addition to everything else, and also the fact that Empire Maker was a terrific horse. It was a lot of reasons. A lot of things conspired to make that day go the way it did at Belmont. And Funnyside didn't even run all that badly in that race. But this is a new ball game, and I don't think, there's no roadmap to judge what Tis the Law has done here. Nobody's ever won, at least not in 100 years or more, a mile and an eighth Belmont. Nobody's ever won in more than 100 years of Belmont that's before the Derby. Nobody's ever won a mile and a quarter race between the Belmont and the Derby. There's just so where we are, and so deeply into uncharted waters here, that I haven't really got my own head around to how we're going to judge all this. But the Derby is the Derby, and that will change the storyline again.
Let's look ahead. And is the Derby the Derby when it's run at this juncture, a time of year when three-year-olds begin to set their sights on the opportunities against elders? And it feels like, we obviously had to set aside that portion of the classic trail for obvious reasons, and so now here we have a group of horses that are arriving, some of which who have already negotiated 10 furlongs. That changes the equation, and then just the fact that it's September and not May changes the equation. Some thoughts about the other two-thirds of the Triple Crown laying ahead.
And what it is I think I wrote in my story for NBC, is that usually when we get to Louisville in late April or early May, really what we're looking at is a crop of horses that have way more question marks than they do answers and known qualities. This time around, again, not with all of the horses, but certainly with Tis the Law, we don't have a lot of question marks. We know that he can run two turns. We know that he can run a mile and a quarter. We know a lot about him. And we know that he's also, 3 months older, 4 months older than he would have been in May. But we know those things about some of the other horses, not the mile and a quarter part. But, it creates a situation where I think people, when we get to Louisville, are going to look at, you're not going to be looking at 20, I don't know if you're going to be looking at 20 horses anyway, but you're going to be looking at a small number of horses that you think can win that race, more like a fall race where the resumes are full. So it's just, again, it's just looking at this thing through a different lens than we ever have before. And you know, these are much more mature three-year-olds now, and some of them, especially Tis the Law, have accomplished a lot more than your usual Kentucky Derby contender.
For what we anticipate, and knowing and experiencing Saratoga in a unique scenario Saturday, and I agree, there was at least, you know, a smattering of people on hand that it was the biggest crowd to date in the first half of the meet, and I imagine, you know, I don't think we'd have a, you know, we're not likely to necessarily have as big a crowd, you know, going forward these next 3.5 weeks. But, you know, how do you anticipate the Derby scene? We know that in the next few days we're going to hear some specifics. There was a press conference yesterday, and Governor Beshear, you know, referencing his ongoing conversations with Churchill, and you know what is going to be obviously a reduced capacity crowd, you know, a limited crowd. But you know, how does the Derby and the Triple Crown season stack up historically in your mind going in?
Well, to your first point, you know, yeah, we are waiting to see what Churchill Downs is going to look like. The last I had heard, they were talking about in the ballpark of 20,000 spectators, no infield. And I had already made a determination that with 20,000 spectators, on top of air travel and a hotel, that I would not be in Louisville. And if that doesn't change, I won't be, unfortunately. Those are tough decisions to make, and this is going to be one of the toughest ones I've ever had to make in my career. But the way it was set up as of my last conversations with people in Kentucky, I wouldn't go to that and expose myself to it agonizingly. As for the historic, you know, there's going to be an asterisk because this isn't the Triple Crown as we know it. After that, it gets complicated. Is it less of a Triple Crown or more of a Triple Crown? And I don't have that answer yet. I think there is something uniquely difficult about those three races in 5 weeks in ascending ascending from the beginning to the end in ascending distance, ending with a mile and a half at Belmont. So I think there is tremendous class if you can get a horse over that 11 weeks from the Belmont to the Derby to the Preakness, and then throwing the Travers in the middle, which, you know, that isn't really part of what we're evaluating here, but we all know it is. So, I mean, it's a huge achievement if Barkley and Tis the Law can pull that off. But the fact that it is over 11 weeks, I did throw in the Travers, so it's, again, that's an X factor. The fact that the Belmont isn't a mile and a half is a huge factor to me. But it's a huge achievement, and it comes at a time when in racing and in sports, everybody wants to really get excited about something, and it's hard to get excited about the NBA games in a bubble. It's hard to get excited about the baseball games in empty stadiums. College football might be about to go down the drain. The NFL is going to try, but who knows? There's a lot to get worried about in sports. There's a purity to what Tis the Law is doing that takes all that away. He's just, when he's out there running, it's just him, and he's not debating whether to wear a mask or not. He's not arguing about the politics of COVID-19. He's just running. And there's a beauty to that that's going to make this a different Triple Crown from anything in history. And that is its own asterisk and a very positive one.
I was talking last night to Andy Serling, and in fact, I forgot to bring it up with Andy, who joined us in the last hour. And you know, given what's going on potentially for September, and knowing that Churchill and NBC had conversations about, you know, fitting the Derby in with the expectation that there was going to be a somewhat normal fall in the offing on the sports landscape. Now it's turning out that that isn't going to be the case. The Kentucky Derby will be seemingly by far the most important sporting event on Saturday, September 5th. It doesn't appear that there's going to be any, you know, titanic college football matchup to counterweigh. This derby, and if he should win, it would set up, would it not? An avalanche of interest?
Well, I think so. But at the same time, we are in a very unusual time historically. You know, I mean, the space in which we consume news and sports is very noisy right now. And I think it's hard for anything in sports or even in the broader world to just break through and be the thing that everybody's talking about, right? There just is no thing that everybody's talking about right now, except on September 5th. I do think the U.S. Open tennis will be going on that weekend. I'm not sure what their exact schedule is, whether we'll be into, so I mean, there will be something big going on somewhere else. At the same time, the Kentucky Derby is usually the biggest thing on the first Saturday in May. I think it will occupy a similar place on the first Saturday in September. But as to whether 'Tis the Law explodes on that day and becomes this thing that all of America is consumed by, I think on that day all of America is still going to be consumed by the virus and still very much consumed by an election that's coming up 2 months later and by all the noise that goes with those two things. So I want to be careful about saying that, you know, if 'Tis the Law wins by 4 in the evening of September 5th, that all of a sudden the name 'Tis the Law is going to be on the tip of everybody's tongue. I think there will be a lot of excitement, but I just think that, you know, let's be careful what we ask of the Derby and of that horse, because it's competing with a lot of noise in America right now, and, you know, not even much of it is sports. So I think it'll be a hugely big deal, but things are just different, and I don't think we know what that's all going to look like if he wins the Derby. And I know as a journalist, I'm not going to force people to care more than they might care. I'm going to tell them how big this is and how amazing it is. But people's minds are occupied in a lot of ways right now, and they can get a little respite from that by wrapping their arms around a horse like 'Tis the Law, but they can't get away from everything. That's just not possible. So I just think my approach to all this sports in a pandemic is, at the very least, it's all very different. And I just don't think 'Tis the Law winning the Derby is going to change that.
Tim Layden is with us, and it always, you know, it's always a pleasure to hear Tim's insights and perspective, which bring in historic overviews and the perspectives and the prism of the social backdrop. And Tim, for you this summer, I suppose that part of every conversation we have swings around to your other sports interests and the areas of competition that you have been fascinated by, and track and field certainly a big part of it, the Olympic movement, as they call it. Some thoughts about what else has gone on this calendar year, what else has been derailed, and how you've treated it, including a look back, I think last month, right? Not even last month, a few weeks ago, the story from the 64 Tokyo Olympics.
Mm. Yeah, I wrote a story about Bob Hayes and Mel Pender, two guys that ran in Tokyo. And again, Steve, everything has this overlay of the times we're living in. That story was written because it was going to be published right before the start of the Olympics in Tokyo, because it was about the last Olympics in Tokyo. But now that there are no Olympics in Tokyo, and we think there will be Olympics in Tokyo next year, but once again, anybody who talks in absolutes right now is talking out the wrong part of their body. We just don't know. And if there are Olympics in Tokyo next year, they are going to look different from any Olympics we've ever seen. Maybe not on television, except I don't envision full stadiums unless it's all Japanese people. I think from a media standpoint, everything has changed forever. There's going to be fewer open locker rooms and fewer mixed zones and just less interaction between media and athletes. And maybe the public doesn't care. But I just think that's something that's going to change. And I just think there are ways in which sports are going to be changed for good in the way that they conduct themselves as a result of this, because there will be other viruses. Now we know that. And I just think that we're going to behave differently as a society, and sports are part of that. And if you're a media person, none of it's going to be good, except that it's kind of intellectually fascinating to examine and report on right now. But when we're all out of this on the other side, it's going to leave residue that I don't think any of us will find pleasant. And again, back to racing, maybe racing will be a little different in that regard. But I do think the personal interaction that takes place will be very different. The people that go to Kentucky that cover the Derby, very few people will be able to go to the barns every morning and talk to everybody. And that's a big part of being at the Derby. So it's just, there's little differences that are going to remain, and there's bigger differences that are in effect now. And I just think they've really impacted sports in every way.
How else have you spent the time? Because I think everybody had at least a portion of their days or what might have been summer break vacations. You certainly would have had coverage obligations. What else has caught your attention, and did you find yourself exploring something that was new to you or engaged you somehow?
No, I am writing a book, so I've spent some time with that. And I've also been working steadily for NBC. I mean, the one thing, Steve, and you can relate to this, as a journalist or as a media person, you spend a lot of time by yourself in a home office somewhere talking to people on a phone or on Zoom, so that never changed much for me, that part of it. What you're talking about or what I'm talking about to those people has changed dramatically, and those interludes where you get out into the field have been fewer and further between. My wife and I did go on a vacation to a remote place. We got tested before, we got tested after.
Nice.
We saw people on the beach partying, and it was disconcerting. Again, I don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole, because a lot of people think you should be able to party. But it was somewhat nerve-wracking to see. But my life hasn't changed a ton. I've tried to still do journalism. I've tried to still do writing. But obviously the social part of it has changed. That's why it's been nice to get out to a couple events and see my old buddies and not shake hands, but maybe do an air fist bump and talk about sports and talk about what life has been like. But I think everybody has a little PTSD already, and it's going to get worse. I don't think that we really realize that till we get out the other side. There's days, I think, like most people, where things feel normal, and there's days when I feel like I want to crawl out of my own skin. If you haven't had that kind of roller coaster, then you're probably in the minority.
Tell us about the book.
I'm working on a memoir of my life and my life as it relates to sports and my family and what I've done as a professional and what I did as an athlete. And it's a lot of things all mixed into one. That basically it's about a memoir of a life that's been guided by sports in every imaginable way.
Well, and you've always been drawn to some of the less highlighted arenas too, and notably track and field and horse racing we think of, and you've also got an appreciation for amateur athletics in general.
Sure, and I think that as we've talked about before, Steve, I think there's great stories anywhere, sometimes I think one thing we've found. This was happening before the pandemic, but in terms of sports journalism, I think that there's been a huge push to write about sort of the unexamined, unexplored story rather than the big, broad story that we sort of all know. And people have had to turn over rocks and look under them during this time because there have been very little live activity. And the live games we're seeing, there's very little opportunity to report on the edges. You know, if you're in Orlando covering the NBA bubble, you're getting a game and then you're getting two players on a Zoom call, even if you're there. So I think the opportunity to look in places where you might not have previously considered looking has become a bigger thing now, and I think that will continue to be true because the media's access to the big names will be less than ever. And that, I think that will even be true in horse racing, although maybe not to the same degree.
Well, the part of that that makes me smile is that in racing, we've always had to go, to the subplots because the star athletes don't really have a lot to say when you go, other than the occasional, bite on the arm and screech for a carrot or a mint. But the other side, though, I mean, the human stories in racing from virtually every perspective, that's what makes the game so wonderful. The jock, the trainers, the groom, the staff, the breeder, the developer, the talent, the owner. There's so many tangents that come off the four legs that we've always been doing that when it comes to reporting on and relaying the stories about racing.
For sure, and I think that's the thing about. You want to write about people that have experienced life, and there's a lot of people in racing that have experienced life, and that makes it great. And, a college football player can be a fantastic athlete that inspires and entertains millions of people, but if he's 18 or 19 or 20 and has basically played only football his whole life, there's not a lot of story there. There's a lot of success and excitement, but racing has a lot of story. And Olympic sports have a lot of story because Olympians struggle. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And people in racing struggle. People have long days, and you lose a lot more than you win. And, it makes for good writing. Obviously, the best stories are where there's story and a broad audience, like an NFL player with a real story is the jackpot. But, but racing has stories, and we've always known that. And the best part of Tis the Law's story is that, I think we watch NBA games now, and we watch golf, and if you're a human being and you're living through this time, you watch it, and even if you're 99% entertained, you're 1% wondering, should we be doing this? Is it safe? Is it the right thing? Should we be putting our attention somewhere else in the culture right now and put sports aside? When Tis the Law is running around Saratoga Racetrack, you're not worried about any of that. Tis the Law didn't weigh in on this. He's just doing what he does. And, like you said, he can't tell us how he feels, but I think we have a pretty good idea that he doesn't know that there's a global pandemic going on, except maybe he wonders why his trainer and his assistant trainer and his groom are wearing a mask every morning. But I'm not, it's just, there's a level of comfort watching Tis the Law that I don't have watching the Lakers right now.
Really well put, and a perfect coda to the conversation. Tim Layden, it's always a pleasure. I'm bothered that I won't see you in Louisville, it sounds like, but we'll certainly talk about it as we do along the Triple Crown Trail every year, every opportunity. I so appreciate the visit.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Tim Layden, everybody, and BC Sports, and longtime Sports Illustrated, and before that, of course, his days in our area, in Albany, in the Capital District, at the Times Union. He also worked downstate at Newsday, and one of the great voices around the game, racing. Lucky that Tim continues to write about it, and that his employers direct them in our direction. We're going to look out to the West Coast and catch up with Michael McCarthy because he, of course, won the La Jolla on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening here in the East Coast. Michael, congratulations.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. And, you know, we also, I'll admit freely, there's also some derby doings involved in this call because, Rushy on the list has got points, was, you know, added to the nomination list. And, we're a little curious. What's going on with Rushy before we talk about Smooth Like Straight?
It's a strange year. You know, obviously, had the Kentucky Derby been held first Saturday in May, he wouldn't have made it. There's more than a few horses on the list right now, 20, that wouldn't have made it. But strange times, strange circumstances, horses training well. We've got two races to choose from that weekend at Churchill Downs, the Pat Day Mile or the Kentucky Derby. If you really want to, any way you cut it, it looks like a three-horse race in the Kentucky Derby right now, Authentic. Tis the Law, Art Collector. Everybody else is sort of in the same boat after that. Strange things happen in the lead up to the Kentucky Derby. Doesn't matter what month it is. A lot of pressure involved. A lot of things happen. I thought it best just to go ahead and prepare this horse as if he is running the Kentucky Derby. It'll be a game time decision. No payments are really made until time of entry. So we'll see. Horse is doing very well. He's due to work on Thursday. You know, it was missed to work before the bluegrass and kind of finished a very idle third there, but looked like he was going to make some noise at the 3/8 pole. By the quarter pole, he kind of seemed like he had flattened out, just kind of stayed one pace through the lane. But we've got some options, which is nice to have. Certainly a decent horse in his own right and getting better with racing.
Well, and that sounds like a pretty open-ended potential for him to make Derby if the decision falls that way. I'm a little surprised you either subbed Authentic in for Honor AP or kind of.
I guess you could call it a four.
Okay, all right, all right.
Call it a four. You can call it a four horse race.
All right, I wasn't sure. I wanted to see how sacrosanct that top three was after Honor AP, you know, ran I can't call it disappointing, but quizzical. Let's call it that. What are Rushy's attributes in your mind? And you certainly, you know, in your time with Todd Pletcher, you certainly have seen plenty of Triple Crown type prospects and classic distance prospects. What are the positives when you look at trying the race?
His horse is very easy on himself, very good mind. As I said, he's getting better with racing. He's by Liam's map and out of a Colonel John mare. Colonel John, obviously a winner at a mile and a quarter, I believe a Travers winner, and whatever else he may have won. But he's got some stamina in there in that pedigree. He's got a little combination of speed and some stamina, which obviously helps in a race like the Kentucky Derby. He's a horse that eats up the bottom of the feed tub every night. Just a horse with a good attitude, easy on himself, as I said, and takes everything in stride. You know, obviously this year with possibly having fans, possibly having no fans, I think it'll play out a lot different for multiple entrants. Sometimes you get 150,000 screaming people hanging out of the rafters and shouting at you from the infield. Sometimes these horses tend to lose it a little bit. This year probably be a little bit kinder to all participants because of the pandemic. I actually think it might even change the outlook of the race as far as the first quarter goes. I believe, you know, horses get so keyed up between the mile Kentucky home and then the crowd cheering. And when they do spring the latch, I think it's kind of a cavalry charge into the first turn. And most guys are jockeying for position while trying to stay out of harm's way. But I do think the crowd plays a big part in that. And I think maybe this year without anybody in the fans, maybe you'll see, you know, not so much a slower opening quarter, but a little bit more of a calculated kind of run into the first turn.
That's a valuable perspective, Michael. I appreciate that. I also have to ask, because when these decisions are made, obviously ownership, the principal conversation. And for the Danielles, for Jim and Donna Danielle, this is, this to some degree is their first big horse. And, even though the Derby experience is not going to be what the normal Derby experience would be leading up to the weekend, it's still something that owners and prospective owners around the game are eager for and hunger for. How much Derby fever is involved for the Danielles right now?
I wouldn't say they have Derby fever yet. It's something we've discussed on a weekly basis. It doesn't take up a lot of our time. They've been to Churchill Downs before for the Breeders' Cup. They were majority partners in a filly named Vibrance, who was third in the Breeders' Cup juvenile fillies. It is a family affair for them. Grandchildren, nieces, nephews, all that, son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, all that kind of thing. It's a real family thing for them. This year, with limited participation, I think they're probably not as excited as some people would be. So it's going to be a game-time decision. The horse is doing well. That's all I can ask for. These things go up in smoke real quick, so we are keeping expectations tempered for the time being.
Well, and he certainly seems, coming out of the bluegrass, to have come out sharp, and feels like one of these horses that is blossoming down at Del Mar as well, coming off of a bullet half mile, 47 flat on the 29th, and then just the other day, last Thursday, another nice 5 furlongs, 1 minute and 2/5. So clearly you got him on edge, and it seems timing-wise like the trip to Louisville for the Pat Day Mile or the Derby, you'll have an active hot property. How about Speech? Talk about the filly.
Doing very well. Came out of her Ashland effort in really good order. Very high energy filly. Keeps everybody on their toes around her. Loves to train. Really loves to work. She's had a couple of decent works since she's been back. We'll go ahead and work on Thursday. Obviously, with the way things are shaping up here and some of these quarantine issues and what have you with riders and jockeys and people coming in and out of states, we're hoping we get the services of Javier Castellano. Don't know what's going to happen, but we thought they made a fantastic couple. Hopefully they can go ahead and reunite again that first Friday in September. Philly's doing great. Looking forward to getting back there with her.
Speech, of course, coming off the Ashland win, and when you look a little further, even down the down into November, and think about Breeders' Cup, Michael, having that win at Keeneland, gotta feel good about natural development, and we've been saying for months upon months how, how terrific the distaff division is going to be, and that was even before the 3-year-old fillies got involved.
It's a super crop of 3-year-olds, a super crop of mares in the handicap division. Shaping up good, like it could be probably the best race of Breeders' Cup week if everyone stays healthy.
Well, that effort, of course, we talked about with Michael after Speech beats Venetian Harbor. We talked yesterday to Richard Baltus about his weekend, and we'll shift our gears away from Oaks and Derby prospects for Michael's Barn, and let's talk about Sunday, another nice 3-year-old, Smooth Like Straight, the Midnight Loot, of course, standing at Hill and Dale, and Smooth Like Straight and Umberto Rispoli, who really seems to have kind of recaptured his momentum that he displayed when he arrived in the U.S.
Very talented rider. Seemed to get along with Smooth Like Straight, hand in glove the other day. race unfolded a little bit like we thought it would on paper. I thought he would be the dominating speed. A little surprised to see us turn up the backside. Mike Smith come and join us, coming through the 5/8 pole. Umberto seemed to stick to our game plan. It never panicked. Horse was always moving well within himself at the 3/8 pole. When he put a half length on Mike's horse, I started to feel pretty good about our chances. He's a horse that's been very easy to be around. Never really touts himself. He's just a really, really classy individual. Does everything you ask of him. He's got some gears I don't think we've got to yet, which is exciting. I think there's some room for improvement. We've been selective in where we've run him this year. Obviously, with the shutdown of racing here on the West Coast, missed a few opportunities. Thought we would go ahead and take advantage of what Churchill Downs was offering in the War Chant. Sent him back there. Was very pleased with what I saw with his race back there. Not eligible really for anything out here in California. Opening day Oceanside is now the winners of the sweepstakes, graded sweepstakes, and obviously being a grade three winner in the Great Cecil at the Mill last year. Had to wait for the La Jolla. Horse had done everything right this summer. Was very glad to see him vindicate his performance in Kentucky.
You have options. I mean, having won at Churchill, that War Chant, there is the American Turf, but when's the Del Mar Derby?
Del Mar Derby is closing weekend here. The American Turf is obviously Kentucky Derby weekend back there, so we've got a couple of options. Very excited to lead him postward in either one of the two. We'll let him get his feet underneath him here for a few days and kind of dictate what we do.
Well, and we should mention, I bring up Midnight Lute, who we just laud constantly, and not just because Hill and Dale is part of the show, but Midnight Lute just gets any kind. And this is a homebred for Cannon Thoroughbreds. In fact, the mare, Smooth as Usual, she dropped a full sibling this year. And when they saw what Smooth Like Straight was like as a two-year-old, they had the opportunity to go back. They went back to Midnight Lute, actually, even before he had, I think, right? Let's see, 17, 18? No, they did get a chance to see what kind of a baby they had in Smooth Like Straight. So there's a full brother that is coming on down the road. And you must like the fact that you had a hand in even in the dam, because the dam was by Flower Alley.
Yep, yeah, it goes... It's nice how these things come together. You know, it takes, you know, it's been a decade or so, or even over a decade since I've laid eyes on Flower Alley, but nice to be a part of his career. I've spent some time with him in South Florida, Boynton Beach, Palmettos, obviously then to be around him at Churchill Downs for the Breeders' Cup Classic. So, yeah, it's kind of nice when these things kind of work out like that. It gives slight sense of nostalgia. I don't see a whole lot of Flower Alley in him. I see a little bit more Midnight Lute, but I would be happy either way, whichever he showed more of. Very exciting horse. Looks like there's some upside there. Try to pick another spot or two before the end of the year here, and hopefully he blossoms in his four-year-old season and is as good as we think he is.
Well, before we wrap with Michael McCarthy, and got to look ahead to this week, and I see that you got that Calbred coming back, Eagle in the Sky, and back-to-back second-place finishes for this two-year-old, and give us a feel, the Sky Mesa that has, boy, you want to talk about a glittering ownership trio, pretty impressive, Eclipse and Barber and company. So how about Eagle in the Sky, going to break through this week?
Obviously facing open company, a little bit deeper water than what we're used to. Seems like a horse that would appreciate the stretch out. Sky Mesa, stats are very good on turf. There is a Calbred race the following week. The way races were filling around here lately, some of these two-year-old races have been a little bit light, so my concern was the race not filling. Thought we'd go for the low-hanging fruit. as far as entries go, and make sure we were in a race that went. I think he's as got a good chance as anybody in the race. Horse is training well, looks well. He seems to be maturing with each start. Hopefully we can go a little bit better here this week.
And get over, and you got a few others, but I wanted to ask about the maiden, and that is coming up on Saturday. Michael, no matter what, looking forward to seeing you in Kentucky with the speech and with Rushy. And congratulations again to you and the Cannon team on Sunday's success. We'll talk soon, and we'll await a decision. But either way, it looks like Rushy's going to be on the plane to Louisville for something.
Thank you, guys. I noticed you had Tim Layden on earlier. I didn't get to hear anything. Who is his pick for the Kentucky Derby?
I think it's going to be tough to get him off of Tis the Law.
Yeah. Yeah. Should be exciting. Thank you, guys, for having me on.
Michael, always a treat, and you can follow follow Michael MWM on Twitter, MWM Racing, and always fun. And I think we got some insight into whether Rushy, how serious Rushy is about a Derby try, and it seems like he's kind of maybe right. Seemed pretty good. That's a nice pair of horses to bring. Either way, no matter what they do with Rushy, if he goes Pat Day or Derby, and then speech, of course, in the Oaks on Friday, pretty good. Want to thank Bill Gallo, Andy Serling, Bill Downs, Tim Layden, and Michael McCarthy. I'll resist the the nickname. We're not supposed to call him that anymore. Good luck today. A fun day racing ahead. And midweek Wednesday show tomorrow. Sid Fernando, Sirewatch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by the home of Midnight Lou, Hill and Dale, and much more. Talk to you in the morning. Thanks, everybody.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Ah, Saratoga. It's history. It's tradition. It's world-class racing. It's jump racing. Yes, steeplechase racing has played a role in Saratoga's rich history and tradition since 1864. And today, it's a part of what makes Saratoga so special. Watch every Wednesday of the meet and two special Thursdays featuring the Grade 1 AP Smithic on July 23rd and the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup on August 20th. Savor the thrill of horses flying over fences. Steeplechase racing, it's a Saratoga tradition.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Pletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow. What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.